In the age of unpeace, great power politics has become like a loveless marriage where the couple can't stand each other's company, but they're unable to get divorced. And as with an unhappy couple, it's the very things that brought them together during the good times that become the means which they use to hurt each other in the bad times. If you take those stories together, Chinese bullying, Russian trolling, American regulation, French blockades, Iranian piracy, Turkish border policy, Brazilian blackmail, they don't look ostensibly like they have very much in common with each other. They're completely different types of stories in different parts of the world. But they do have one fundamental thing in common, which is that they were not new types of political violence. Each was a weapon which was perfectly evolved to exploit a weakness in our connected world. Migration is one of the most powerful weapons that has been used in the world that we're in at the moment. I think it's high time that we saw that connectivity, whether we like it or not, is a double-edged sword. Once we accept that it means conflict as well as cooperation, we can start implementing strategies that minimize discontent, that limits the violence that it brings in its wake.
Was ist Krieg im 21. Jahrhundert? Für diese Frage haben wir Marc Leonard eingeladen. Marc Leonard ist Politikwissenschaftler und Direktor des European Council on Foreign Relations, eines preisgekrönten Thinktanks über europäische Außen- und Sicherheitspolitik. Außerdem ist Marc Leonard der Autor des Buches The Age of Unpeace, How Connectivity Causes Conflict. Das Buch verlinken wir euch in den Shownotes. Bevor es losgeht, aber noch ein Hinweis aufs nächste AHA-Festival. Das findet am 26. und 27. Januar 2024, wie gewohnt, im Südpol in Luzern statt. So, jetzt geht's los mit Marc Leonard und Was ist Krieg im 21. Jahrhundert? Viel Spaß mit der Audioversion dieser Lecture.
Good evening. Thanks for your lovely introduction, Christoph. I'm going to speak in English. I hope that's okay. Christoph gave a very generous introduction about my CV as a think tank director and author. But if you ask me who I really am, I think the honest answer is that I'm an optimist trapped in a world that seems to favor pessimists at the moment. Christoph has asked me to talk about this idea of war in the 21st century and how we should think about it. I'm going to try and explain what I mean over the next 45 minutes. The Bulgarian intellectual Ivan Krastev summed up how many people in Europe felt when they saw these familiar but almost forgotten images of death, destruction and suffering return to our continent in February this year by comparing the current era to the 1920s and the 1930s. People in those decades thought that they'd been living in a post-war world, and future historians re-described that era as an interwar era. And what he was implying is that many people would say the same about the period that we were living in before February the 24th, 2022. But although Putin's attack is abhorrent and shocking and has brought these images back to us, my main argument tonight is that it would be wrong to assume that this fight in Ukraine is just another leg in this age-old journey between war and peace, which Tolstoy described in his great novel. My sort of core point that I want to make is that Tolstoy, were he alive today, would not be able to write his book. In fact, nobody could, because that distinction between war and peace has been blurred to such an extent that it has become a bad description of the world that we're living in. And it's not just that the war in Ukraine didn't actually start in February last year, but started 8 years earlier, as Christoph was saying. I think it's the fact that the world was already full of violent conflict even before the war, before the annexation in Crimea. And what that means is that even when the most violent fighting in Ukraine ends, it's unlikely to be followed by peace. In fact, it will be just the opposite. And to understand why, I want to look at some of the other stories which have been taking place over the last few years, which might not have looked like war, but actually have a lot of the features of conflict in their heart. And what they show is that many of the things which were meant to bring the world together, which people thought in their most optimistic times would lead to the creation of one world, are in fact having the opposite effect. So before Ukraine, the big story that we were all focused on was about COVID. And when the virus first struck, many people thought that this would be a moment for the world to come together to focus on its common survival. But quite soon during the crisis, the Chinese government had started hoarding medicines, masks, and PPE. As COVID spread around the world, a lot of these supplies were used both to bribe and to blackmail other countries into making political changes. Countries that were seen as friendly to China, like Brazil, Serbia, and Italy, were showered with masks and medical equipment. But more critical states like Australia, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, the US faced threats to withhold supplies unless their government changed policy. So another big story of the last few years is the Black Lives Matter movement. And when George Floyd was murdered, a wave of protests went around America. And there were all sorts of social media posts calling for violence against the fascist police. And what happened looked to many like a global political awakening, as you saw all sorts of people calling for action right around the world. But what became clear as the crisis, as the movement built, was that a lot of these posts on the social media were not organic, but actually been orchestrated by troll factories in Ghana and Nigeria and other places, which were funded by the Russian state. Another big story was the story of Huawei, which shows that conflict over technology is becoming a kind of central piece of geopolitics in the world. Google and Huawei had worked together very, very closely for many years. They built a partnership between the biggest hardware handset maker in the world and the most widely used operating system. But when the American government put the Chinese handset maker on a banned list, you saw Huawei banned from using the Android platform, and lots of people's phones couldn't be updated, and Huawei went into a kind of crisis, and you saw a series of tit-for-tat actions which leading to sort of balkanization of technology around the world. This is a picture of the supermarkets in Britain in December 2020. Which ran out of fruit and vegetables when the French government closed its borders. And this ban on British lorries was ostensibly about controlling COVID at a time when it was coming back. But many people in the British government thought that this was designed to put a squeeze on Downing Street in the Brexit endgame as they were negotiating the withdrawal agreement from the European Union. This is an Iranian ship, and it's a story of the Iranian Navy seizing oil tankers to protest against the crippling sanctions which the US had imposed on Iran, with the kind of use of piracy designed to break a financial blockade. Here's another story from around the same time, a couple of years ago, in Turkey. The president opened his country's borders to Greece and urged lots of Syrians to go across the border to seek a better life in Europe. But his goal wasn't really to help them follow their dreams. It was rather to use the threat of a wave of refugees to extort concessions from the European Union. And this is an image of wildfires in the Amazon rainforest. They've shocked a lot of people around the world to care about climate change. But unfortunately, the then Brazilian president, Bolsonaro, wasn't one of them. Instead, his government tried to use the concern of others to extort money from the international community and get payments in return for reducing clearance of forests. So if you take those stories together, Chinese bullying, Russian trolling, American regulation, French blockades, Iranian piracy, Turkish border policy, Brazilian blackmail, they don't look ostensibly like they have very much in common with each other. They're completely different types of stories in different parts of the world. But they do have one fundamental thing in common, which is that they were not sort of random accidents like an asteroid falling from the sky or an earthquake, but rather new types of political violence. Each was a weapon which was perfectly evolved to exploit a weakness in our connected world. And every time one country uses one of these tools, another reciprocates, which has turned the world from seeing globalization and interdependence as a kind of positive thing that brought opportunities in its wake to one where these links are seen as risky, and we're seeing a kind of escalation of measures and countermeasures, which is creating a kind of deadly spiral of tensions in many parts of the world. And the book that I wrote, The Age of Unpeace, is a short volume with a very simple idea, which is that the connections that knit the world together are also driving it apart. And in a world where nuclear powers is existential, what we're seeing is many countries waging conflicts by manipulating the very things that link them together. The conventional wisdom before February this year, certainly in Europe, February last year, when Russia invaded Ukraine, was that we were living through a golden age of peace. But at the same time, as I'm sort of trying to argue now, beneath the kind of superficial idea of peace, what we saw was a huge amount of tension and violence that was ripping through the world every single day. And there is a word that tries to capture this liminal condition suspended somehow between a state of war and a state of peace, which academics such as Lucas Keller, who are working on cyber, tried to use to describe this gray zone in which their world was immersed, where every day you saw millions of attacks which fell short of conventional war. And they rehabilitated this Anglo-Saxon word of unpeace. And my argument is that as violence is spreading from the weaponization of the internet to every single facet of globalization, that word provides a perfect encapsulation of our condition. And it means, once we can see it, what we're going to have to become familiar with is a much more unstable, crisis-prone world of perpetual competition and endless attacks between competing powers. And part of the reason why everyone's so obsessed with the rule-based order and the idea of world order is that that is something which is increasingly going to be beyond our reach. So welcome to the Age of Unpeace. In the Age of Unpeace, great power politics has become like a loveless marriage where the couple can't stand each other's company, but they're unable to get divorced. And as with an unhappy couple, it's the very things that brought them together during the good times that become the means which they use to hurt each other in the bad times. So in a marriage which is going wrong, it's often about using the children, the dog, the holiday home to hurt each other and to inflict pain on the other partner. But in geopolitics, the big battlefields are, in fact, all the things that were meant to be bringing us together. Economic links, infrastructure, health, climate, technology, migration. And I'm just going to look at some of them in turn so you can get a sense of how these are becoming the new battlefields of our age of unpeace. The military one is the most obvious, the most familiar, particularly since February of last year. And it feels like, in many ways, quite a kind of unipolar world if you look at it in military terms. If this is the military bases which you see around the world, there's a single country which on its own accounts for 40% of global military expenditure. The United States of America, and that's the supremacy which the US enjoys is very clear from the way that the war in Ukraine has been developing, where the bulk of the equipment towards the Ukrainian government comes from the US. And though we're going to see a sort of major rearmament in Europe and Asia after a 30-year peace dividend comes to an end, that preeminence of the US is likely to continue for a while. But I think it's also one of the reasons why some of these other battlefields are going to become more and more important as the world becomes more and more contested. So when the war in Ukraine started, the big story of the first phase of the war was the imposition of unprecedented sanctions by the West against Ukraine. You both had official sanctions, kicking Russia out of the SWIFT system, confiscating the assets of the central bank, stopping all sorts of different goods and technologies being exported to Russia. But you also saw informal sanctions with 1,000 global companies worth about 45% of the Russian GDP threatening to pull out of the country. And many people said that the G in ESG when it comes to companies is being reinvented as geopolitics. And this battlefield of weaponizing the economy and finance has seen many countries using or threatening to use sanctions, boycotts, export controls, import bans for political goals. And this slide just shows a few of the stories that have taken place in recent times. Things like China threatening to introduce car tariffs to pressurize Germany into accepting Huawei's 5G infrastructure, the Turkish boycott of French-labeled goods after Macron announced that he was going to introduce new policies for fighting extremism. But there are dozens of examples of it around the world being used by Western, non-Western countries alike, and in many ways these sort of economic tools are the weapons of first resort because they're a lot less problematic than sending troops into other places. But what's surprising is that many of the other features of globalization are also being weaponized. We talked about health earlier. You would have thought that it would be the ultimate thing that brings the world together. But instead, we've had mass diplomacy, vaccine nationalism. At the beginning of the corona crisis, you saw 98 countries introducing export controls on all sorts of different products, which shows how even something as kind of existential as health can become a political tool. Infrastructure was the other thing which was meant to be bringing the world together. In that battlefield, the Chinese have been the most active power. What you can see is here a map of the so-called Belt and Road Initiative, which China is building to link its economy to 65 countries around the world and to increase its political power by creating bonds of economic dependency between other countries and China. The technology realm is not simply about creating different spheres of influence where different countries try and set standards for privacy, for the regulation of different products. Increasingly, it's very much about the sort of freedom of our societies and our democracy, as so much of the public sphere is now taking place on big platforms. And this is a map which shows that in the decade between 2010 and 2020, there were 41 elections and 7 referendums which were subject to cyber-enabled interference involving well over a billion people. And the other big story that's coming out of the war in Ukraine has been about the sort of weaponization of energy. Russia's number one way of putting pressure on us has been through our gas bills, with prices going through the roof across the continent. But it's not just energy. Climate is also becoming an important battlefield, which I think goes against a lot of the expectations that people had about climate, which was seen to be the ultimate thing that we have in common with each other, the air we breathe, the environment, the world that we live in. But rather than acting as if we're all in the same boat, what you're seeing increasingly is people trying to advance their own interests in this period of carbon transition. Europeans love to talk about how they're leaders on climate change, but what this map shows is what will happen if Europeans introduce a so-called carbon border adjustment mechanism, which they want to do in order to stop what they call carbon leakage, which is the idea that the emissions can simply be exported to other parts of the world if we crack down on high carbon intensive industries within Europe. But what this map shows is that many of the countries that are going to be most hit by those sorts of mechanisms are in the East, and they'll no doubt see these sorts of measures as protectionism rather than environmentalism. But you can see how Ultimately, all these big conferences like the COP and other attempts to deal with climate change, the world is not moving towards the sort of cooperative solutions that people hope we would at the time of the Kyoto Protocol 20 years ago. Migration is one of the most powerful weapons that has been used in the world that we're in at the moment. Putin has displaced 14 million Ukrainians from their homes through very deliberate attacks on civilian centres. I spoke about Erdogan at the beginning, but it's not just Russia and Turkey that have been active on this battlefield of weaponizing migration. Very recently, we saw the Belarusian dictator Alexander Lukashenko and his secret services bringing migrants from the Middle East via Belarus into Poland and Lithuania to push back against European sanctions. We saw the Moroccans trying to put pressure on the Spanish by encouraging migrants to go across the border there. And this map, in fact, shows all the countries that have actively tried to turn migrants into weapons by opening their borders and driving people to move in different places. And over the last few decades, there have been 70 instances of these sort of weapons of mass migration. And what this shows is some work by Kelly Greenhill, which shows how kind of effective this has been. In many ways, using migration as a political lever is more effective than military invasions or the use of sanctions in terms of achieving political, military, or economic objectives. It's a particularly powerful tool for weaker countries against stronger ones. There's no way that Turkey or Cuba could threaten the European Union or the US in a kind of classical confrontation based on military means. But migration is a very effective way of introducing different tools. What I try and do in my book after that is to look at some of the ways and techniques which people are using to weaponize globalization. And this slide shows the sort of seven habits of highly effective connectivity warriors in this kind of world. And as you can see, it's quite influenced by network theory. The starting point for my thesis is the instrumentalizing connections between different countries is not is hardly new. Sanctions, for example, have been used at least since the sort of Peloponnesian Wars thousands of years ago. And many of these other techniques which we talked about have been used by different civilizations in the past. But what is new is the dense network of connections that form the hidden wiring of our globalized world. And the ways that that is being manipulated give sanctions, blockades, PR campaigns, attempts to drive people from their homes, a viral quality and a deadliness that didn't exist before our world was defined by networks. And although the journalist Thomas Friedman famously claimed that our globalized world is flat, it's in fact the opposite of flat. It's flat. It's like a kind of uneven and mountainous network. Some countries are much more central to the system, are connected to all sorts of different players. Others find themselves very dependent on one country for particular products, technologies, raw materials, and that allows them to be manipulated. And you can see that the countries which are most central to the system are often cutting other nations off and using their control of hubs to assert their power. Rather than going in detail through all the different tactics that I have up there of trying to make yourself central, trying to act as a gatekeeper to these different networks, subverting others, infiltrating them, developing rules which favour your interests rather than others, I'm going to talk about some of the different players that have perfected the use of some of these different strategies. And in my book, I argue that instead of moving into a bipolar world where you just have two different poles, which many people talk about when they talk about the kind of new Cold War that's emerging, or the chaos of a completely non-polar world where there aren't any institutions or hegemonic powers that control things, what we're instead seeing is the kind of emergence of a de facto four-world order, where you have three empires of connectivity that have very different ideas about how to organize the planet, and then you have the remaining countries, which amount to a fourth world, being forced to navigate between them. So the first superpower, or hyperpower in this connected world, is the US of A. I call it the gatekeeper power, because when Americans look at the network world, they often focus in on the hubs in the network map, those kind of areas where lots of the different pathways connect, which give you the opportunity to either shut people in or out, or use these hubs for surveillance and spotting other what other people are up to. So after 9/11, officials in the US Treasury started exploring how Washington could leverage the ubiquity of the dollar and the US dominance of the international finance system to target the financing of terrorism. And they developed very, very intrusive and new kinds of sanctions, which were very different from those which had been used earlier on. And since then, the US has used a lot of the same tactics and this privileged position as a hub to limit what others can do and to threaten, penalize them. So what started being aimed at individual terrorist groups then got broadened out at kind of big entire states like North Korea and Iran, and is now being used against lots of different countries, not least against Russia since its invasion of Ukraine. What's very interesting about these different kinds of sanctions is that they don't just apply to American companies, but in fact anyone who wants to use the dollar, which is pretty much everybody. So they have an extraterritorial reach, which makes them incredibly powerful. The other area where the US has a very strong position is through the internet, and Edward Snowden showed a lot of the ways that the NSA and other players have used the American dominance of the global data chains to enhance its power. And now what we're seeing increasingly is the kind of weaponization of certain technologies through export restrictions. So what you have is an attempt to act as a gatekeeper for these kind of hubs within the system. The second big pole is China. When China looks at the world, I call it a relational power because it tends not simply to look at the hubs in the system, but rather all the kind of ties which connect different countries together. The core goal is to try and connect as many countries as possible to the Chinese market and to its political system, and to use these infrastructure links to bind other countries into a Chinese sphere of influence. China used to seek access to Western-centric networks whilst trying to preserve its own sovereignty, but today, its main goal is building new networks with itself at the centre. I showed you the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a very kind of literal idea of trying to connect the world and make sure that all roads lead back to China. But that also takes place in more virtual areas, whether it's through the Digital Silk Road or through the diplomatic links which China is building with the world. China is now the number one trade partner to more countries in the world than any other player. And its main goal is building these new networks with itself at the center. The main power indicator for China is the number of relationships you have and how central you are to the system. The third big superpower in this era of connectivity is Europe, which I call the rulemaking power. When Brussels looks at the world, it looks less at the sort of hubs and the ties between different players, and thinks more about the kind of what rules and norms, what's the operating system for the world. So the European Union itself is a kind of massive network. When new countries want to join the European Union, they have to integrate over 80,000 pages of laws which govern everything from gay rights and the death penalty to the lawnmower sound emissions, the composition of tomato paste, into their domestic legislation. That is the European Union's operating system. It's otherwise known as the acquis communautaire. But the EU doesn't just abide by that operating system itself. It's tried to make everyone who comes into contact with its network follow the same rules. And Europe's used this kind of economic power to put forward an idea of how society should be organized, threatening to exclude companies that don't live up to its norms. We've seen that on genetically modified organisms, where the Europeans have tried to get other countries to stick to their laws. We've seen it on competition policy, where European regulators have broken up big companies in other parts of the world, such as the US. We've seen it with data privacy standards, with the GDPR regulations. People call that the Brussels effect, which is this attempt to try and get the rules developed in Brussels to apply to many other parts of the world. But of course, most of the world's population don't live in the US or China or the European Union, and that is what I call the fourth world, where many people in kind of smaller countries that on the one hand are acutely aware of the ambivalent effects of connectivity. Their big fear today is of once again having to follow diktats from the three big empires of connectivity and being forced to choose between them rather than being sovereign over their own destiny. Many of these countries have been subject to imperialism in the past or found their sovereignty severely curtailed during Cold War I, and they're very scared of a new Cold War where they get squeezed between these other great powers. But interestingly, the world that I'm describing provides these medium-sized powers with more options in geopolitics than they had in the 20th century. where they were outclassed by the superior technology and firepower of superpowers. And what you're seeing is various kind of niche strategies being developed. I talked before about how Turkey's weaponizing migration. You can see the sort of activism of countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran in reaching out to people who are Shia or Sunnis, or using oil or other techniques in order to develop their power. And Russia has been a kind of pioneer of societal disruption, as well as of using its military force in lots of different theatres. So if we look forward, I think many of the biggest dangers are going to come when these different systems clash in the full world order. And I think you could see a whole series of new flashpoints around connectivity in some of the very places that divided the world in previous eras. In some ways, the war in Ukraine can actually be understood as a connectivity war. It first started with the annexation of Crimea, when Putin became so scared that Ukraine was going to go towards the European Union, because Ukrainians were taking to the streets so that they could sign an association agreement with the European Union rather than joining the Eurasian Economic Union, which he had started. And we've also seen not only connectivity create those tensions in Ukraine, which could be seen as of having sparked the beginning of the conflict, but it's also become one of the central ways in which this conflict is being waged. What happens on the battlefield is extremely important, and though the images look like those from the Second World War and other wars, the way that this war is being fought is very, very different. If you look at the way the Ukrainians are fighting the war, technology and connectivity lie right in its center. They're using completely different ways of gathering intelligence, from apps which use open source data which individual Ukrainians are inputting into. They're using drones and UAVs in a way that feels very different from other wars. But actually, if you go beyond the battlefield, you can see how connectivity is absolutely central to both Russian and Western strategies. Putin is reinforcing his military power with the manipulation of energy prices, the forced evacuation of civilians, which are designed to break the will of Europeans and Americans who are backing Ukraine. And on the other side, Europeans and Americans have turned their economies into weapons in ways that were unthinkable. I talked earlier about some of the sanctions which have been used. The military conflict is being seen as just one battlefield on which this war is being waged. And many people see the war in Ukraine as the prelude to an even greater conflict over Taiwan in the future, which could be far more devastating for the world. You can see the sort of escalatory dynamics very clearly, but also people thinking about many of the lessons around connectivity in the run-up to that. So I'm going to end by, after all this slightly gloomy talk about what was going on, to think about what we can do to make the world a bit safer, and how we can try and get a grip over this age of unpeace before it ends up completely destroying all of us. I think in Ukraine, what the West is doing is absolutely right, which is to try and help Ukraine survive and to help them put themselves in a position where they can think about a future as a sovereign democratic state that is able to set its own future, and where its citizens can live in dignity. And I kind of support a lot of the measures that we're taking. But I think if you look beyond that, I think we do need to revisit a lot of our assumptions about the use of force, the nature of our economies, and even the idea of order. When I first started working on my book, it was in 2016, and I was very depressed by some of the ways that connectivity were creating conflict in our societies. First, by the Brexit referendum in the UK and the election of Trump in the US, and this move against a lot of the fabric of our connected world, which was becoming increasingly violent in lots of different places. And what I'd hoped to do was to think about how one could design a new architecture for a more united planet. But the deeper I delved, the more I became aware that the good and the bad features of connectivity are inextricably entwined with one another, and that it's impossible to untangle them without destroying many of the biggest advances of our civilization. And I had an epiphany about the dilemma facing our world during one of my many trips to Beijing, when I was browsing in my favorite bookshop in Beijing, which is now closed down, the Bookworm. I came across a volume called Facing Codependence by Pia Melody, which seemed to capture a lot of the pathologies that beset contemporary politics and international relations. Rather than talking about interdependence as a balance phenomenon, what it talked about was about this idea of codependence, during which the ties between different players become toxic, but also inescapable. And her diagnosis of our condition is not just rooted in the pathology of individual people or countries, but in the relationships between them. It recognizes that a lot of the tensions come as much from psychology as from economics. They're intrinsic to the global system that we've created. They can be managed and channeled, but they can't be eliminated. And most importantly, she starts with the sort of lived reality of her patients rather than the theories of experts. And she tries to find ways of making the patient feel safe rather than telling them that they're mistaken in their fears. The only surprise that I found was that this book was in the self-help section of the bookstore rather than the section on international politics. And that's when I realized that the world needs therapists rather than architects. And rather than trying to eradicate connectivity's dark side with a new grand design, what we need is strategies for shaping and surviving our new reality. In the Cold War, people realized that the biggest threat to humanity was that the nuclear arms race could spiral out of control. And they tried to use that escalation to build trust and to gradually bring the weapons that threatened to wipe out humanity under control. But our dilemma, I think, is much greater, because in the age of unpeace, all the violence that we're seeing, or a lot of the violence, flies under the radar of war and is therefore unregulated. And rather than being trapped in a few deadly technologies that can be counted, surveyed, and controlled, we're living through an era where almost everything can be weaponized. And if the connections that are essential to our well-being are also being turned into deadly weapons, then we have to find ways of making them less dangerous. So rather than ending connectivity, what we need to do is to try and find rules and norms which take the sting out of it, or to disarm it. And my kind of feeling is that if arms control was central to making the Cold War safe, the equivalent for the Age of Unpeace is about disarming connectivity. And that's a Sisyphean struggle, which is a bit like the kind of ongoing therapy that you need to detoxify personal relationships. Although psychologists don't think you can ever cure codependency, they have laid out 5 steps to manage it so their patients can still lead a fulfilled life. And I tried to adopt these steps in my book into a 5-step program for the age of unpeace for our world, based on this idea of disarming connectivity. I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to run through them in great depth. But the first step of all therapy programs is about facing up to the problem. So I think rather than hoping we can go back to the old model of globalization or a kind of new order, which resembled the dreams that we had in the 90s, we do need to prepare for a different world. And we need to start thinking about global politics in different ways. That brings me to the sort of second step. And I talked to the beginning about how many of the things that are meant to bring us together, in fact, seem to be driving us apart. So paradoxically, one of the best ways to unite the world is actually to create enough distance to make people feel safe and in control. People were talking about how the big dividing line in the world was between open and closed societies. But I think that rather than thinking about the world like that, we should think about the dividing line as being between managed and unmanaged togetherness. And the best way to stop people wanting to build walls and to really divide the world is to give them a sense that the connections we have are less dangerous. And that means finding ways of managing everything from trade and migration to technology and cultural change in ways that make people feel more secure. That brings me to the sort of third step, which is being realistic about what we can control. I think there is a kind of utopian hope that you can bring everyone together and develop a kind of globalist philosophy for how the world should work. But the alternative approach of seeing competition as systemic rivalry that your side has to win at all costs is even more dangerous, because that means that every single point of contact you have with others becomes a site for systemic rivalry, and you end up with kind of permanent insecurity. Sigmund Freud once wrote to one of his patients that her therapy would be a success if it could turn her hysterical misery into common unhappiness. And I think the equivalent for international politics would be to transform sort of uncontrolled connectivity wars into a tough competition, but with some limits and rules which can mitigate the risks. The fourth step is really about taking care of ourselves. Our experience of the last 50 years is that equal, free, prosperous states tend to be better neighbors, more constructive international citizens. A lot of the threats to our kind of liberal order come from within our societies rather than outside, and therefore we need to think about how to redesign our education systems, healthcare, social care, welfare, industrial strategies to produce wealth, to distribute it fairly at home, and to build domestic strength and self-confidence, which I think is a really strong foundation for different kinds of international engagement. And the final element is about seeking legitimacy for what we're doing domestically and internationally. I don't really have time to go into all the ways that we can do that, but one of the kind of big problems that we have at the moment, the reasons that people were turning to Trump and to Brexit and other things, was a feeling that we've been forced into a situation where we had no control over our own affairs, and that people were living through changes which they had never voted for. That is something which we need to change if we don't want people to go for autarky and for dividing the world. My book sort of explains, I think, some of the many ways in which globalization, and in particular the digital revolution, make conflict more likely. And I think if we continue on the current trajectory of greater connectivity, greater comparison, competition between different players, we risk entering an age of perpetual conflict where even when we're not officially at war with each other, we're never at peace. And you end up with a kind of nightmare scenarios of escalation. You can imagine a layering of catastrophic cyber attacks, financial crises, economic depression, collapse of global supply chains, going alongside wars like the one we're having in Ukraine, or potentially even a conflict over Taiwan, and that this could all be reinforced by our failure to tackle the climate crisis, which could in turn provoke migration crisis, further pandemics. After the nightmares of the last few years, it's not that difficult to imagine all sorts of doomsday scenarios. And at times of big change like this, it's often more glamorous to point to the way to a new Jerusalem, to sketch out an architecture for a new world order. But I'm convinced that rather than doing that, what we need to do is to think about a much less glamorous program of therapy where we actually are clear-eyed about some of the dangers that we're living through and try and find ways of mitigating it, try and find ways of de-escalating some of the things which are escalating around the world. I think it's high time that we saw that connectivity, whether we like it or not, is a double-edged sword. And once we accept that it means conflict as well as cooperation, we can start implementing strategies that minimize discontent, that limits the violence that it brings in its wake. And as I said earlier, with all psychological maladies, the first step back to health is to acknowledge that there's a problem. And that's the ultimate purpose of this talk and of the book, which it's based on. It's an intervention. Thank you very much.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram und Facebook. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matijašević. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.